BBC World Service. This is Ruth Alexander with The Inquiry. This week, what else could Europe try to deal with its migration crisis? Migrants are headline news.
Nuova strage dei migranti nel Mediterraneo. Almeno 40 persone sono morte, soffocate.
In Italy, a boat lost in the Mediterranean and 40 people drowned.
Bundeskanzlerin Merkel hat bereits von riesigen Aufgaben gesprochen. Gemeint ist die Flüchtlingspolitik.
In Germany, estimates of the number of arrivals this year are breaking all records.
Just nu kommer rekord många ensamma barn och ungdomar som flyktingar till Sverige.
In Sweden, the authorities are dealing with an unprecedented number of unaccompanied children.
Állítólag már el is kezdték kijelölni a kerítés helyét. A határ mellett élők híradónak azt mondták.
In Hungary, they're building a fence to keep immigrants out. And in Britain,
the Calais conundrum: how to keep Britain's border with France open to the free flow of traffic, but not to the free flow of migrants.
100,000 migrants were recorded arriving in the European Union in July, three times more than in July last year. Numbers like this haven't been seen in more than 20 years. They're arriving in greatest numbers from Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea and Nigeria, but also from Kosovo, Pakistan, Gambia, Mali and beyond, seeking asylum or work. Europe has been struggling to cope. So, our inquiry this week is looking for new solutions to what's being called a migration crisis. What else could Europe try? First, let's look at what Europe is trying.
Part 1. Europe's response.
Personally, I have palpitations on most days.
Elizabeth Collett finds it hard to switch off. The director of the think tank, the Migration Policy Institute Europe, she spared time to talk to the inquiry during her holiday.
Apparently, I can't take one without bringing my work with me or doing some work alongside it. There's a constant low-level sense of tension in the air.
In her office in Brussels, Elizabeth is thinking about the bigger picture. Capsizing boats full of migrants are dominating the headlines, but they're the tragic symptom of a much deeper problem. Yes, it's the sheer numbers that are arriving as people flee conflict zones like Syria, but also...
it's a symptom of, I think, a broader dysfunction within the current asylum policies that we have within the European Union.
It's not just the numbers, it's the way people are reaching Europe, because the EU doesn't make it easy. There aren't many safe routes into Europe to claim asylum, which is why many decide to risk their life in a smuggler's boat. And once an immigrant arrives in Europe, they're meant to claim asylum in the first country they reach. That means Italy and Greece have been dealing with many more migrants than countries further away from the Middle East and Africa, the areas from where most migrants are travelling. But people are also allowed to move freely around Europe, and some migrants choose not to register at the country they arrive in, as they're supposed to, but to move on immediately to another European country. Some are more popular than others.
And this is creating tensions both within countries with respect to capacity, but across the EU from the point of view of equity. Is everyone doing their fair share to manage this system? On the one hand, it's a capacity issue and what I would call beggar my neighbour policies that certain countries are adopting, which is to try and shift responsibility away from your own country and not really mind that that then creates an additional burden for the country next door.
Crucial to the problem is that EU countries can't agree on how to share the burden of immigration, and just trying to keep people out hasn't, so far, solved the problem.
There are trade-offs with border management in terms of whether you want to create high walls and high fences or whether you try and do intelligent border management that seeks to create security while facilitating certain level of access to the European Union. And finding that balance, I think, will be extremely difficult for the EU in the coming years.
Even the EU's effort to seize or destroy smugglers' boats isn't getting to the crux of the problem, she says.
It is fundamentally a short-term solution. To me, it's resemblance of a sort of political theatre, this idea that we are doing something and we're being seen to be doing something, whether or not it is ultimately effective.
A
I think it's going to have to look for some bigger solutions, and we might be at that point where some more radical thinking is needed.
The rest of this programme is about what those bigger solutions might be. All of the expert witnesses we'll hear from agree on one thing: migration is inevitable. So, what else could Europe try?
Part 2. The Australian Model.
The mantra, if you like, that was used was that we will decide who comes to this country and the manner in which they come. That was the directive from the Prime Minister. And therefore, asylum seekers who arrived by boat without prior authorisation were sent off to Nauru or Papua New Guinea.
Jane McAdam is Professor of International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. Australia has a total ban on migrants arriving uninvited by boat. Anyone who tries ends up not in Australia, but in another country altogether.
Back in 2001, Australia, under a Liberal government, that is a Conservative government, created the first offshore processing centres. These are bilateral agreements with two Pacific Island countries, Papua New Guinea and Nauru, whereby those countries agree to take asylum seekers who've tried to get to Australia by boat. They are kept there in detention.
In return for holding Australia's immigrants and then processing their applications for asylum, Papua New Guinea and Nauru get Australian aid money. It was started after more than 400 asylum seekers en route to Australia were rescued from a sinking boat by a Norwegian freighter.
It was a very hot political issue, and the idea was that this would deter asylum seekers from coming by boat, ostensibly to save lives at sea. And I have no doubt that that was certainly a heartfelt reason for some politicians, but I think there were also many that simply thought this is just one way we can shut down boats, try and shut down the people smuggling trade.
Here's how it works. Asylum seekers get in their boats and make their way, or are intercepted and sent, to Australia's Christmas Island. They're given health checks there and then flown by the Australian government to Papua New Guinea or Nauru. And if they're found to have genuine asylum claims, the idea is they're resettled not in Australia, but in Papua New Guinea or another country Australia's managed to get agreement with, Cambodia. Has that worked? Has this policy stopped migrants coming to Australia?
That's the million-dollar question, if you like. The government maintains that it has stopped the boats. The information blackout means it's very difficult to know.
More concrete, Jane McAdam says, is the evidence about how asylum seekers are treated.
There are considerable human rights violations that occur in the offshore processing centres that have been well documented by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees that has been able to go in and examine the conditions.
You might also wonder about conditions in Cambodia, where the refugees are supposed to settle in the end. Well, the refugees have been wondering about that too. And so far, only four, yes, four people have agreed to go there. But presumably, it is possible, at least in theory, to operate offshore processing centres without abusing people's human rights. So could Europe make this model work? Processing asylum seeker claims in another country and then settling the refugees elsewhere too?
I don't think Europe should follow the Australian example, because, in fact, a number of the practices we see in Australia, which are unlawful as a matter of international law, would certainly be found to be unlawful by the European Court of Human Rights.
But some think processing immigrants offshore could be an option for Europe. Indeed, Europe's toyed with this idea on and off for the past 30 years, and now it's back. The European Commission's proposed that a pilot centre be opened in Niger. Others could follow in key transit countries like Tunisia, Egypt, Lebanon and Turkey. The attraction of the idea is that it might reduce the number of people making desperate journeys and arriving unannounced on Europe's shores. Although there's a question mark over how immigrants would make their way to these centres. And could a system like this really handle the tens of thousands of claims the EU receives a month? It's far more than Australia has to manage. Even if it sorted these problems, Europe would still be left having to find agreement about where to send successful applicants.
If you look at the number of refugees that there are in the world today, there's a severe lack of resettlement places being provided. And I think that, you know, that at the end of the day, the political will to do something about it is really what we're seeing as lacking.
To get hundreds of thousands or even millions of people resettled in new countries would require global cooperation on a grand scale. Is that even a distant possibility? Well, it's happened before.
Part 3. The Boat People.
My wife and I met here 30 years ago.
This is Cortland Robinson speaking to us from Thailand.
She's Thai. We were both working at a refugee camp and fell in love, and I fell in love with the place as well as a person.
Cortland is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in the United States, and he witnessed the Indochinese migrant crisis of the 70s and 80s, going on to write what's considered the book about it.
This is the east coast of Malaysia, final destination. Thousands of refugees fleeing Vietnam. Many don't make it this far. They're attacked by pirates, drowned, or starved to death.
After the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, more than a million people fled the country by boat, documented here by the CBS 60 Minutes programme.
Anyone who was seen as a friend of America was afraid they would be seen as an enemy of the new regime. And rather than stick around and find out if they were right or wrong, if they could get out, whether by air, boat, or otherwise, they did so. And that was the first wave. It was 100,000 plus. And in 79, the exodus really took full force and form. And it was at that point, tens of thousands of boats were leaving.
As far as we could tell, no one drowned coming ashore.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And just for that, some were grateful.
Thank you, thank
you. In 79, we had a full-blown global crisis, the Indochinese refugee crisis.
People were crammed into boats. There were thousands of boats. Where were the boats heading?
They were heading really any place they could go, but the word was that if they survived the exodus and they found their way to Thailand or Malaysia or Indonesia or the Philippines, that there would be some hope and promise of settlement elsewhere.
But as they came close to landing, the boats were pushed back to sea. Thousands of people died. The United Nations had to act. A groundbreaking agreement was reached. If the Southeast Asian countries would stop pushing back the boats and let the refugees ashore, countries like the US, Canada, Australia, France, Germany and the UK would resettle them.
Dozens of countries from Asia and the West came together and said, we have a problem, let's find a solution.
And that worked well for a while.
I think it worked well for quite a long time. It also provided, I would add, what we called the orderly departure program, which said, let's not even compel people to get on the boats if we can move them directly out of Vietnam. People could leave directly from Vietnam if they had the paperwork. And hundreds of thousands ultimately did that too, and that was highly successful.
But in the late 1980s, the agreement began to break down.
A lot of the countries were saying, this was not what we had intended. We weren't here to make permanent offers of resettlement to anybody who fled Indochina. And it became more and more of a U.S.-only or certainly U.S.-led intervention. And many countries were beginning to complain and saying, you know, we're worried that actually this is creating a magnet effect. It's drawing people out who would not otherwise have left. And so we saw a new surge, and a large number of people began to arrive by boat into Hong Kong and Malaysia and Indonesia and Philippines and Thailand. And at that point, patience snapped, and the military navy began pushing boats back again.
But the international community came together again and agreed an unprecedented solution. Resettlement would continue. Local countries would stop pushing back the boats, and those with a genuine fear of persecution would be resettled, while the others would be sent back in an orderly fashion.
Several hundred thousand ultimately did, in fact, receive a designation of refugee.
The key to solving the Indochinese migrant crisis was international cooperation. How likely
Correct.
Is it that we could achieve that kind of working together today, in your view?
Well, yeah, frankly, if I were a betting man, I wouldn't bet on it.
If Cortland Robinson is right that today's world powers won't be able to come up with another grand-scale agreement about how to share out the resettling of the world's refugees, what else could Europe try?
Part 4. A change of perspective.
Spent a summer in an asylum reception centre for refugees in the Netherlands. I wasn't doing very much other than sort of helping build a playground and organising activities for kids. And at the time, the late 1990s, there were people from Kosovo, Bosnia, Liberia, Iraq, Iran, China. And it was a real inspiration for me to be around people who were talented, well-educated, but in many cases denied the right to work.
Alexander Betts was a student then. Now he's a professor and director of the Refugee Study Centre at Oxford University. He says the key to solving the migration crisis is to see that the worst of it isn't in Europe at all.
We need to understand that the majority of the world's refugees are not coming to Europe. They're in regions of origin. Take the Syria crisis, for instance. We've got 4 million Syrian refugees, but 3.5 million of them are in countries like Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey. With Somali refugees, the majority are in Kenya. And it's those countries in the region of origin that bear a disproportionate responsibility for hosting refugees. And those are the places where ultimately we have to find solutions.
It's a question of rethinking the whole problem.
We need to be creative about how we support host countries in regions of origin. We've got to recognise that simply writing checks to support countries like Lebanon and Jordan isn't enough. And I think one way in which we can do that is change the paradigm of how we look at refugees, not just as a humanitarian issue, as has traditionally been the case, but also a development issue.
Trying to help those countries see refugees not as people who have to live in a camp without work permits or any real citizen rights, but as a bonus new workforce.
If they're given the right to work, if they're given freedom of movement, then we can actually help refugees to be a benefit rather than a supposed burden on the host countries in the region of origin.
And he's seen, he says, the perfect place to start in Jordan.
Just a 15-minute drive from the now famous Zaatari refugee camp, home to 83,000 refugees, is a special economic zone. And that special economic zone lacks a couple of things. It lacks labour and it lacks inward investment. Now, if we imagine zones and spaces like that that are underdeveloped being opened up to allow refugees the right to work alongside citizens of the host country, and having inward investment by companies, perhaps companies that were operating in Syria but can no longer operate in Syria, then we could create an opportunity not only to incubate the post-conflict economy of Syria, but spaces where refugee hosting becomes an opportunity for countries like Jordan to actually improve their development position.
If refugees were helped to make a living and a contribution to a local economy, Europe would see fewer of them turning up on its shores, he reasons. So Alexander Betts's idea is that Europe and other international powers could come together not to share out the resettlement of refugees on their own soil, as happened with the Vietnamese in the 70s and 80s, but to help them resettle closer to home. They should invest in fledgling economic and business zones and give companies tax breaks to set up there. But how would European leaders persuade their voters that this was a good use of their money?
I think it's very important to recognise that Europe doesn't have a choice about whether it engages with the global refugee crisis. It has a question of how it engages.
You can imagine there'd be opposition on the ground, though, can't you, from people in Jordan or Kenya, say, who would think, well, why are these refugees getting all these opportunities? You know, I'm looking for work. I want work.
Inevitably, if you provide disproportionate opportunities to refugees, you risk creating animosity with host populations. But where these development approaches have worked in the past is when host communities also benefit, where job opportunities are provided to the host community alongside the refugees.
This idea might sound too good to be true, but Alexander Betts says there was a precedent in the 1990s.
Mexico, for instance, with a significant number of Guatemalan refugees, recognised that it had areas of underdeveloped land. In the Yucatan Peninsula, for instance, in a couple of areas that were really underdeveloped, Campeche and Quintana Roo, it agreed to provide self-reliance opportunities and local integration for Guatemalan refugees. And they were able to contribute enormously to the agricultural development of those areas. The initiative was significantly supported by development funding provided by the then European Community.
Our first expert witness told us Europe needs some big ideas, and our last expert witness has provided one. But Alexander Betts's proposal still wouldn't get Europe off the hook in terms of the resettlement of refugees, and it would require a lot of international money and commitment at a time when both are in short supply. We've heard how, in the 1970s and 80s, the world did come together to solve a migration crisis, but that a similar approach is unlikely to get very far today. Then there's the Australian example, a system designed to keep migrants, including refugees, at arm's length. It's a policy which some in Europe admire, but the obstacles, practical, legal, and diplomatic, would surely be immense. It could be that some combination of these ideas could offer Europe a solution, allowing it to juggle an economy which could use some immigrants with a welfare system already under pressure, to balance complex internal politics with its urgent humanitarian obligations. Or until people no longer need or want to flee broken countries like Syria and Eritrea, it could be that Europe has no realistic option but to muddle through and hope for the best. In other words, what it's doing right now.
This inquiry was presented by Ruth Alexander and produced in London by Tim Mansell. If you have a question you think we should be asking, demand an inquiry on the World Service Facebook page or on Twitter. We're BBC, The Inquiry.